four members of the Walmsley family ran along the street, following it for perhaps 2 minutes or more. The object, picking up speed, was finally lost from view in the vicinity, as Alice Walmsley puts it, of the big round house, the Stonehenge apartments. She provided a crucial detail. When she first saw the UFO, she was lounging in her bathrobe. Not wanting to miss anything, she had run outside to follow it down the street wearing only her robe. She was in her bare feet, too, but she remembered that it was a very mild night and she wasn't at all cold, a real surprise for January. We had originally checked the weather conditions for several reasons. 1, as a routine matter to gain background information. 2, to see if it would have been possible to dig up soil that conceivably was frozen. And 3, to check on George Obarski's statement that he heard the UFO's hum because he had his car window partway down, due to the mildness of the weather. Mrs. Walmsley running down a New Jersey street in January in her bare feet provided a special confirmation of the date and circumstances of the landing. A final matter was the question of the UFO's color. Jerry asked the Walmsleys their recollections. The body was dark gray or even maybe black, said Robert, and we had a final verification. So the North Hudson Park UFO scouted a landing spot on Monday, January 6, 1975, at 3 a.m., and was seen by Dorman Gonzalez. At 9:30 p.m. on Saturday night, it returned, passing low over the area, and was followed down the street by the Walmsley family, dazzled by its lights and its peculiar hum. It sped over the park again and disappeared somewhere near the Stonehenge apartments. Then, a scant 5 hours later, it was back for its mission. It landed in front of George Obarski, the crew disembarked, dug their soil samples, fired a warning shot at Bill Pawlowski, and departed. The whole mysterious business took place over 6 days and must have been witnessed by many more than the 8 people I have described. Alice Walmsley's sister, whom I have not mentioned, provides a 9th. In the months following these events, Ted Blocher, George Obarski, myself, and the others involved in the case have speculated on what it all may have meant. It seems absurd on the face of it to imagine that the entire episode occurred because a UFO crew, whoever they may be, actually needed soil from North Hudson Park. Could the mission instead have been a species of theater, a display of imagery designed to communicate certain basic information? Ted Blocher and many other experienced investigators seriously entertain this theory. Looking coldly at the implications, this is what one might deduce, thinking metaphorically rather than literally. 1. The need to take samples of Earth connotes a non-Earth origin or habitat, that is, the idea of extraterrestrials is conveyed. George thought of our astronauts taking rock samples on the moon. 2. And the unknown, magical propulsion system of their craft suggests a technology far in advance of ours. Scientific superiority is strongly conveyed. 3. Yet, the two, armed, two-legged kids in snowsuits suggests a race of people like us, arid therefore not terrifyingly alien. 4. Their diminutive size and neutral behavior towards George Obarski a mere 60 feet away implies definite non-hostility. 5. The shot which broke the window at Stonehenge Apartments might imply a warning and the possibility, if threatened, of their turning hostile. It has been suggested that the entire enterprise involves both information gathering and, at the same time, a consciousness-raising effort by subtly imparting the idea of their presence to us mere Earthlings without unduly alarming us. If this is their goal, they are achieving it remarkably successfully. The Gallup poll on the subject of UFOs shows that a constantly rising proportion of the population accepts the possibility that we are, indeed, under extraterrestrial surveillance. No one I know has yet panicked from the widely published accounts of UFO activity, Orson Welles and his War of the Worlds notwithstanding. The North Hudson Park landing received a great deal of press and television coverage following my rather detailed piece in the Village Voice. Frank Gonzalez, the Walmsleys, George Obarski, and other witnesses were interviewed by various TV crews. The case itself, I must point out, involves additional UFO incidents which I have not gone into here. Ted Bloch's excellent and thorough two-part series in FSR2 should be consulted by the interested reader. One high point of the television coverage was a 1976 talk show hosted by Stanley Siegel and shown over New York City's Channel 7. The guests were Dr. Robert Jastrow of NASA's Goddard Lab, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut who headed the second moon landing, Dr. J. Allen Hynek of the Center for UFO Studies, and witnesses Betty Hill and George Obarski. After recounting the events of that night in North Hudson Park, from the moment his radio ceased playing to the almost unbelievable sight of the UFO lifting, off in near silence, George was faced with this problem. Stanley Siegel, apologizing in advance for the question, said that his viewers would demand he ask it. George, did you really see these things you've described? Do you have a drinking problem? A history of mental illness? Was this witness telling the truth? There was a pause and George leaned back in his chair, and spoke slowly and directly. I always figure like this, if a man, as I have, has lived a reasonably honorable and decent life for 73 years, he isn't going to do something that's crazy, and in one wild burst destroy his whole life's history and decency. There was no studio audience that day, but the cameraman and technicians nodded and smiled at one another, responding with genuine warmth to George's unmistakable integrity. I noticed one additional thing. When Stanley Siegel asked these questions, George never for an instant mentioned the fact that there were other witnesses. That William Pawlowski independently confirmed the landing. He declined, one might say, to borrow from another man, and defended his account on the sole grounds of his own truthfulness. At the time of the North Hudson Park investigation, neither Ted Bloch nor I knew very much, first hand, about abduction cases. It occurred to both of us, however, that there was a nagging time problem in George's account. If the UFO incident spanned only 3 or 4 minutes, and George arrived home at roughly 3 a.m., then he couldn't have left his Manhattan store until 2:15 to 2:30 a.m. The 20-block drive from his shop to the Lincoln Tunnel, and then along Boulevard East to the park, can hardly have taken more than, say, 20 minutes at that time of the day. George closes his store at midnight, but hardly ever works as long as 2.5 hours before heading home. He has also mentioned to me that he has, from time to time, a sense of having been told something by the silent figures, something he cannot grasp or remember. I suggested one day that he think of undergoing hypnosis to see if there might be a part of his experience that has been deliberately blocked from conscious memory. No, sir, he answered. When the doctors put you under, you're out there somewhere and you may never come back. I told him about a witness who was currently undergoing hypnosis to recall a lost period of time in a similar case. How's he doing? George asked. He's finding out some fascinating things, but it's been emotionally draining for him. George beamed at my answer. You see what I mean? I was right. You'll never see me getting hypnotized. The essential deduction to be made from the North Hudson Park landing is not that it, too, could possibly involve an abduction. It is that we have an example, a vivid example, of the freedom of movement enjoyed by a UFO craft, a freedom which suggests just how widespread such abductions could be. We are not limited to dark country lanes and isolated Nebraska farms. One of the witnesses to a related sighting near North Hudson Park on Boulevard East reported a brightly lit, windowed object just over the top of the palisade. He stopped his car and got out to watch it. The UFO then moved off towards the George Washington Bridge, and instantly all of its lights blinked off. He watched the dark mass speed away, a nearly invisible blot in the night sky. The UFO that George watched land might have blinked off its lights. And there could easily be a more complicated scenario here than any of us imagines, though it will forever remain speculation. I have only raised the issue to demonstrate the complexity of the problem. Very recently I was in George's store and we were having a rather philosophical chat. You know, Bud, he said. I'm not a religious man. My wife was religious. But I'm getting on, and I figure I haven't got a lot of time left, so I think about it. I figure if there is a God, and I face him sometime, I'll just say, Lord, you didn't give me all the brains in the world or all the advantages, but I did the best I could with what you gave me. And I figure he'll have to accept that. And if he does, I'm gonna say, okay, Lord, here's one I want to ask you. Who were those little guys I saw in the park that night? Where are they from? Are you their God, too, or what? Next chapter, a sharp right turn on the national road. Not everyone having a close encounter with a UFO is as uninformed about the phenomenon as was George Obarski, who had to ask me one day what the initials UFO stood for. When Ted Blocher, in January of 1978, introduced me to Stephen Kilburn, one he explained that he and Steve originally met at a 14 conference, a gathering held by enthusiasts of the writings of Charles Fort. Too like Fort in his day. They remain dedicated to the study of various strange and unexplained phenomena, including UFOs. At the time, Steve was an undergraduate at the University of Maryland, but when he moved to New York and married, he phoned Ted to re-establish their friendship. Ted invited him to an informal meeting of UFO researchers at my studio, and there we met. Stephen Kilburn is a shy, intense, and haunted man. He is young, not quite 30, and strikingly attractive. In fact, more than once he has turned down invitations to make modeling his career. Instead, he is dedicated to a career in the arts, the study of which he supports by his 9-to-5 job. His shyness and seriousness are captivating, accompanied as they are by an understated, natural honesty and directness. At our meeting, he was content to listen, making very few contributions to a general discussion of recent UFO cases. But through it all, one felt that things were percolating inside him, and shortly I came to realize that he was, for no immediately apparent reason, uneasy. From his 14 connections and his friendship with Ted, Stephen was acquainted with the basic shape and complexity of the UFO phenomenon, though he had read very little of the literature, or the specific case material. By the time he had attended 2 or 3 of our rather sprawling, unstructured gatherings, he had heard some talk about the use of hypnotic regression in suspected abduction cases. One night early in 1978, as a meeting was breaking up, Steve stopped me in the downstairs hall. He has a way of shifting about nervously, his eyes fixed shyly in middle distance, and then suddenly raising his eyes to meet yours in a steady, pleading gaze. The effect is riveting. There's probably nothing to it, he said, but something may have happened to me when I was in college. I can't remember anything specific, but something has always bothered me about a certain stretch of road I used to pass through whenever I left my girlfriend's house in Maryland. I don't know if there's anything to it, but I think there may be. I asked if there had been a UFO sighting connected with his experience. No, that's just it. I can't remember anything specific, but I just feel something happened to me one time when I was driving home. It cost him a great effort, I knew, even to bring the matter up, but especially to make a request. Sometime, whenever there's an open appointment, I'd like to try hypnosis, just to see if there's anything to my feeling after all. The next day, when I talked to Ted by phone, I mentioned the conviction in which Steve had described the uneasiness he felt whenever he was on that particular length of highway. At this point in our understanding of abduction cases, we accepted the Hill case and others like it as a general model. Though witnesses might realize that there had been a period of unaccountably missing time, they would still consciously remember having seen a UFO and/or occupants. The surrounding circumstances would have high definition, only the abduction itself would have been blocked from conscious memory. What could we think about a man who, practically speaking, remembered nothing whatsoever of the experience, and who had nothing more solid to go on than a deep, seated fear of a certain stretch of highway? It seemed an almost ridiculously flimsy pretext for entering into the costly and time-consuming process of hypnotic regression. And yet Stephen was, himself, a special case. If anything, I believed, he was the kind of man who would naturally downplay his feelings rather than artificially exaggerate them. Ted and I weighed the various factors involved and decided that the situation should be explored. Towards the end of 1976, I had met Dr. Robert Neyman, a psychiatrist who occasionally uses hypnosis as a therapeutic technique. He is very experienced in this method, having employed hypnosis for over 15 years to help some of his patients overcome smoking addictions, problems of overeating, and so forth. In one interesting case he told me about, the patient of another psychiatrist could never remember his dreams, so for weeks he came to Dr. Neyman early in the morning, was hypnotized and instructed that he would be able to recall his dreams when he visited his analyst later in the day. This strange two-step process, he assured me, was ultimately successful. Dr. Neyman had very little information about the UFO phenomenon, and no really strong opinions about it one way or the other. However, he is a generous, thoughtful man with an inquiring mind, so the prospect of exploring the memories of UFO witnesses was evidently interesting to him. He agreed to give us some of his time, and we began, early in 1977, to use hypnosis in several time-lapse cases we suspected might be actual abductions. The results were fascinating and varied. In one case that is still under investigation, two young men and a young woman, driving near Kent, Connecticut, in September of 1973, watched a large, hovering UFO disgorge a series of individually moving lights at treetop level. The three then drove to the place where they'd seen the lights glide down a hillside to a lower road. As they sat in their car, about 20 helmeted figures approached them, and the next thing they knew the figures were no longer there, and, somehow, 2 hours had passed. Under hypnosis, one man remembered nothing whatsoever of the missing time period. The second man, a Vietnam combat veteran, had a dramatic breakthrough, however, and recalled at least some of the startling subsequent events. 3. In another case, Dr. Neyman was working with a man who, he believed, had a serious memory block. In his second hypnotic session, the subject underwent a frightening physical paralysis of both arms, a symptom that has since been observed during the hypnosis of other suspected abductees. In fact, even when these subjects are brought out of their trance states, the paralysis of hands and arms has lingered, sometimes for minutes, in a situation only slightly more disturbing for the subject than for the surprised hypnotist. In the spring of 1978, Bob Neyman introduced Ted Blocher and me to psychologist Dr. Gerard Franklin, a colleague he was training in the use of hypnosis. Since the demands we were making on Dr. Neyman were always at the edge of the unmanageable, he suggested that we ask Dr. Franklin to help with our investigations. And so it happened that in May 2, our time period conveniently became available and we arranged an appointment for Stephen Kilburn. Dr. Franklin was not curious about the UFO phenomenon. On the contrary, he was very skeptical, and so was hardly prepared for what unfolded. For that matter, none of the four of us, Stephen, Dr. Franklin, or I, expected anything dramatic to occur. On the way to his appointment, Steve apologized to Ted for having inconvenienced all of us, since he felt there may very well be nothing specific behind his fear of that stretch of Maryland highway. Ted assured him, as I did later when I arrived, that whatever did or did not come out of it, the session would function as a kind of control, an experiment aimed at discovering if deep-seated feelings of dread such as Stephen experienced might indicate a buried traumatic event, or perhaps have come about for other, internal psychological reasons. Either way, an answer would be helpful. Dr. Franklin's office is on the ground floor of his Upper West Side Manhattan brownstone. After introductions all around, Steve sat down on the leather couch and began to detail the background of his feelings, while Ted set up his cassette tape recorder. There was a marvelously uncomplicated honesty in Stephen's voice and posture as he spoke. His eyes were steady and met Dr. Franklin's scrutiny head on. S.K., Before I came to New York, I used to have a girlfriend, we're still friendly, and I used to drive from Baltimore, it was Peeksville, to Frederick, Maryland, to see her. I would take Route 40 west, and for, I'd say, at least 10 or 15 miles of that road, it was very, very deserted. And very often I'd be at her house very late at night and come back, and it was very dark. The streets weren't lighted at all. And, about, I'd say probably at least a year after I was seeing her, I was driving along the road from Frederick to Baltimore. I don't remember whether I actually saw something in the sky. I believe I did, and it was there that I first felt that something. I felt very strange, for some reason. I didn't know why. It was that feeling someone is watching you as you wake up, that sort of thing. I don't know whether someone was watching me or I was watching something strange. Whatever it was that particular time, I remember I felt that something maybe had just happened to me, or was going to happen, and it was this very weird feeling. Every time I passed that approximate area, I felt for some reason something right there had happened. And I really just put it out of my mind as a sort of an event I had experienced, or from reading some novel, or whatnot. But I always wondered if something really had happened to me at that time. Now, I can't say for sure, but I believe I was a little bit confused about the time, a loss of time on that one main experience I had. It's possible, of course, that I'm mistaken, but there's something about it that I've never quite understood. And I don't even know what questions to ask to find what answer I'm looking for, if that makes any sense. I never felt that way in any other place at any other time. I either have a very vivid imagination, or it was just it was a very dark road, that was for sure, and it did occur to me as I was driving that this is the kind of place that something like that, a UFO encounter, should happen. This was part of my hesitation for wasting your time. I hope I'm not doing that. GF, it isn't a waste of time, because if nothing happened, that's as informative as if something did happen, so don't worry about that. It's not a waste of your time, either way we would be okay. SK, okay, that satisfies my, well, I remember various other details, if that's important. I believe I was driving my sister's car, which is a Toyota, during this particular incident, and I did not always drive her car. For some reason, I have a very strange memory of looking at the dashboard. I don't know if I was looking at the clock or not, but I do remember seeing it, and I don't remember why. Do you remember any thoughts that you can elaborate on? SK, well, I just remembered as you asked. I see my car pulled over to the side. One think it was the center. There was a big median, grass median, and I see me walking. I see the car at an angle, and I see me walking from the front of the car to the right, and I see a light, from the car, I'll think it's from the car, I'm not sure, and, one don't see me meeting anybody or doing anything, going any place, but I distinctly have there, feeling of me being out of the car, and my car stopping, and again, this is something that flashed through my mind, like a memory, or a scenario that could have happened. And also, driving alone, the source of his being watched, would have been to the right, overhead, whatever I felt was there over me, or possibly I was looking at it. It's just so very black, very dark, and it was a clear night, I think. GF, do you remember what you were thinking about it? SK. I was scared. GF, you were? SK, oh, I was scared. Yes. I mean, shivers down my spine, that kind of thing. Not petrified. But very scared. GF, real scared. SK, yes. In fact, I had the feeling of being trapped in my car and wishing I could go faster. GF, and get out of there? SK, yes. And someone in back of me, with a faster car, that kind of feeling. Also, I have the memory of looking in the mirror to see if someone was looking for me. GF, it almost felt like there could have been. SK, yes, like I was being watched, or followed, or something like that. The feeling, I think, to sum it up, was that I wasn't there alone. G.F., right. You had a sense of some presence, or something, of being watched, followed? S.K., yes. And also some kind of feeling of power that somebody else had. These were feelings that probably went through my mind very quickly, but I had that feeling, and I'd be feeling it every time I passed this area. I distinctly remember it once. I think it was the first time it happened. Also, I remember that driving on this particular patch of road, like on many highways, there was a kind of a large hill, like embankment, covered with grass, and I think there was a fence and trees, there were trees behind the fence. Pause. I think that it was in front of me while I was driving. Must have been a long way off, because I could see my headlights getting lost in the darkness dash. Couldn't see the road ahead of me. Again, I don't know if this is my imagination, after this many years. And if I were to hazard a guess, it would probably be 2 or 3 in the morning. It's just a guess. It's like it had gotten a little bit chilly. I think I had a light jacket dash. Can't say for sure. I think the rest of it, I'd just be guessing. GF, would you feel ready now to try the hypnosis part and try to see if we can make anything out of it? SK, okay. GF, all right. How would you feel about lying down? Stephen made himself comfortable and Dr. Franklin began the process of inducing a trance state, but at this point a slight technical error occurred. The tape recorder had been placed on the floor near the couch, but we discovered later that for some reason it did not pick up Steve's very quiet voice with enough volume for us to distinguish his words. Luckily, however, when it came time during the session to turn the tape over, Ted repositioned the machine and the later, more important part of the hour was successfully recorded. Initially, Steve talked about being in the car, driving home, and feeling drowsy. He described opening the window to freshen the air, and at one point bending down towards the dashboard for some reason. He told of his car stopping and of his confusion about what was happening. He lay absolutely motionless in a deep trance state. His voice was soft and his words slightly slurred as he described standing alongside the car and looking uneasily towards the metal fence. There was a long pause and he seemed afraid to go on with his account. He was obviously confused and frightened. Suddenly, he cried out as if in pain. It's on my shoulder, a clamp. It hurts. I can't move. Dr. Franklin tried to soothe his fear, but then a curious accident served to deepen his fright. A few feet away from the couch was the doctor's automatic phone, answering machine, which at that moment intercepted a call. It made a sudden loud click and Stephen literally almost leapt a few inches off the couch. He cried out again. His fear was palpable, his voice conveyed panic, and tears flowed down his cheeks. Dr. Franklin took immediate measures to calm him, assuring him that he was safe and that he would be able to tell us exactly what was occurring. Earlier in his instructions, he had explained that Ted or I might also occasionally question him, so now, after the tape was turned over and the recorder moved closer, Ted took up the dialogue. TB, are you still standing next to your car, Stephen? SK, yes. TB, can you see what's on your shoulder? SK, agitated, yes. TB, what does it look like? SK, big wrench. TB, where is it coming from? SK, I can't tell. TB, behind you? SK, agitated, yes. It's long, it's a big, not a wrench. TB, grappling hook? SK, no, no. A wrench, it fits. TB, a wrench? SK, Stephen's body moved as if in pain. TB, you say it fits up against your shoulder? SK, yes, it's, yes. TB, how far down does it go? SK, all the way. A foot, on either side of my body. TB, how far? Down to your chest? SK, Yes. TB, does it fit closely to your body? Or is it uncomfortable? SK, yes. Agitated, yes. I think that it,